Chapter 5. The Transcendent Quality of Conscience. In the existential analysis of dreams in the preceding chapter, the psychological fact of repressed and unconscious religiousness became obvious, and the empirical results of existential analysis came up to its ontological expectations. In fact, if the existential analysis of conscience is carried further, one will be confronted with a very significant finding, which may best be described as the transcendent quality of conscience. To illuminate this finding, start with the following assumptions. All freedom has a from what and a to what. The from what of man's freedom is his being driven, and the to what is his being responsible, his having conscience. These two facets of the human condition are best expressed by a simple admonition from Maria von Ebner-Eschenbach. Be the master of your will and the servant of your conscience. From this sentence, from this moral imperative, we would like to start to illuminate what we have called the transcendent quality of conscience. Be the master of your will. Well, I am already the master of my will insofar as I am human and fully aware of my humanness. That is to say, insofar as I am interpreting this humanness in terms of responsibleness. But if I am also to be the servant of my conscience, then I may ask whether this conscience has not to be something other than I myself. Might it not be something higher than he who merely perceives its voice? In other words, I cannot be the servant of my conscience unless I understand conscience as a phenomenon transcendent of man. So I cannot consider conscience simply in terms of its psychological facticity, but must also grasp it in its transcendent essence. I can be the servant of my conscience only when the dialogue with my conscience is a genuine dialogos, rather than a mere monologos. This, however, can only be so when my conscience transcends myself, when it is the mediator of something other than myself. It would seem, therefore, that the phrase the voice of conscience, common to so many languages, is based on a mistake. If conscience had a voice, it could not be a voice itself, the voice of transcendence. Then man would not only overhear this voice, it would stem from him. But only the transcendent quality of conscience makes it possible to understand man in depth, or more specifically, to understand his being a person. The very term person, seen in this light, takes on a new meaning. For now one may say, through the conscience of the human person, a transhuman agent personat, which literally means is sounding through. It is not up to us to answer the question of what this agent is, since our concern with the origin of conscience is anthropological rather than theological. Nonetheless, we may be justified in claiming that this transhuman agent must necessarily be of a personal nature. More correctly, however, we would have to speak of a transpersonal agent of which the human person is but the image. So conscience is not only a fact within psychological immanence, but also a referent to transcendence. Only with reference to transcendence, only as some sort of transcendent phenomenon, can it really be understood. It is like the human navel, which would appear meaningless if it were taken as an isolated phenomenon. The navel can only be understood in the context of the prenatal history, for it points beyond the individual to his origin in his mother. It is the same with conscience. It can only be fully understood as a phenomenon pointing to its own transcendent origin. As long as we consider man as an isolated being without the context of his origin, some things about him must elude our understanding. And what holds for the ontogenesis of man is also true of ontology. We cannot ontologically understand such a human phenomenon as conscience unless we reach back to its transcendent origin. Conscience is fully understandable only against the background of a transhuman dimension. To explain man's being free, the existential quality of the human reality would do. However, to explain his being responsible, the transcendent quality of conscience must be considered. So conscience, which we have taken as our model of the spiritual unconscious, is seen to have a key position in disclosing to us the essential transcendence of the spiritual unconscious. The psychological fact of conscience is but the immanent aspect of a transcendent phenomenon. It is only that piece of the whole phenomenon that seeps into psychological immanence. If conscience is the voice of transcendence, it is thus itself transcendent. Viewed in this light, an irreligious man is one who does not recognize this transcendent quality. Needless to say, the irreligious man also has a conscience, and he also is responsible. He simply asks no further, neither what he is responsible to, nor from what his conscience stems. But this is no reason for the religious man to become haughty. Consider the biblical story of Samuel. When Samuel was a boy, he once spent a night in the temple with the high priest Eli. He was awakened by a voice calling him by name. He rose and asked Eli what he wanted, but the high priest had not called him and told him to go back to sleep. The same thing happened a second time, and only when it happened a third time did the high priest tell the boy that the next time he heard his name called, he should stand up and say, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth." If Samuel failed to recognize that the call came to him from transcendence, how much more difficult it must be for an ordinary person to discern the transcendent character of the voice he perceives through his conscience. And why should we be surprised if he takes this voice for something that is rooted merely within himself? The irreligious man thus proves to be the one who takes his conscience on its psychological facticity. Facing it as merely an immanent fact, he stops prematurely, for he considers conscience the ultimate to what he is responsible. However, conscience is not the last to what of responsibleness, but the next to last. On his way to find the ultimate meaning of life, the irreligious man, as it were, has not yet reached the highest peak, but rather has stopped at the next to highest. This, of course, is the way the religious man looks at the irreligious. And what is the reason the irreligious man does not go further? It is because he does not want to lose the firm ground under his feet. The true summit is barred from his vision. It is hidden in the fog, and he does not risk venturing into it, into this uncertainty. Only the religious man hazards it. The more religious a man is, the more he will respect the decision of this fellow man not to go further. After all, it is precisely the religious man who should respect the freedom of such a choice, because he is the one who believes man to be created free. And this freedom includes the possibility of saying no, for instance, by deliberately refusing to accept any religious Weltanschauung. To be sure, among those who have committed themselves to an atheistic or agnostic worldview, there are some who are ready to accept the concept of transcendence, but do not feel that this necessitates that they speak of God. However, there are others who do not see any reason why not to denote transcendence by the age-old word, God. Conscience not only refers to transcendence, it also originates in transcendence. This fact accounts for its irreducible quality. Therefore, if we raise the question of the origin of conscience, there can be no psychological answer, but only an ontological one. Any attempt at a mere ontic reduction, any attempt to reduce conscience to psychodynamics, proves futile. This was clearly seen by the 19th century writer Hebel, when he wrote a letter of May 13, 1857, addressed to Utrecht. Conscience stands in striking contrast to any values that might be put forward by materialism. If one tries to reduce conscience to the sexual drive or to the instinct of propagation, something that surely will happen sooner or later if it has not already happened, even then conscience will be neither explained away nor done away with. What Hebel prophesied here has in the meantime happened. Indeed, psychoanalysis has tried to explain conscience in psychodynamic terms, reducing it to the superego and deducing the superego from the interjected father image. However, just as the self cannot be identified with the ego, likewise conscience cannot be identified with the superego. Rather, one must acknowledge the irreducibility of these two phenomena, the existential quality of the self and the transcendent quality of conscience. As to the first phenomenon, Man's being responsible can never be traced back to his being driven. The self can never be traced back to any drives or instincts. The self has the function of repressing and sublimating the drives and instincts, but can itself never be derived from them. Even if instinctual energy is utilized in repression and sublimation, that which puts this energy into motion cannot itself be explained merely in terms of instinctual energy. Has anyone seen a river building its own power plant? It was man who dammed the water to utilize its energy. But just as drives and instincts cannot repress themselves, likewise the self cannot be responsible merely to itself. The self cannot be its own lawgiver. It can never issue any autonomous categorical imperative, for a categorical imperative can receive its credentials only from transcendence. Its categorical character stands and falls with its transcendent quality. It is true that man is responsible for himself, but ultimately he is not responsible before himself. Not only man's being free, but also his being responsible, requires an intentional referent. Just as freedom means little, indeed nothing, without a to what, so responsibleness is incomplete without a to what. Goethe once said, "Alles Wollen ist ja nur ein Wollen, weil wir eben sollten." Whenever man wills, this act of will always presupposes a grasp of what he ought to do. The ought is ontologically prior to the will. Just as I can only answer if I am first questioned, just as each reply requires a to what, and such a to what must be prior to the reply itself, so the to what of all responsibleness must necessarily be prior to responsibleness itself. What I feel I ought to do or ought to be could never be effective if it were nothing but an invention of mine, rather than a discovery. Jean-Paul Sartre believed that man can choose and design himself by creating his own standards. However, to ascribe to the self such a creative power seems to be still within the old idealistic tradition. Is it not even comparable to the fakir trick? The fakir claims to throw a rope into the air, into the empty space, and claims a boy will climb up the rope. It is not different with Sartre when he tries to make us believe that man projects himself, throws himself forward and upward into nothingness. It may be said that the psychoanalytic superego theory comes down to the contention that the ego pulls itself up by the bootstraps of the superego out of the bog of the id. However, the superego is not the only thing regarded as an interjected father image. The God concept, too, is interpreted in terms of a projected father image. Now let us, for heuristic purposes, play off the psychoanalytic view against the theological. A Copernican switch would be the result. For theology, God is not a father image, but rather the father is an image of God. In this view, the father is not the model of divinity, but on the contrary, God is the model of paternity. Biographically and biologically, the father is first. Theologically, however, God is first. Psychologically, the relationship between the child and his father is prior to the relationship between man and God. Theologically, however, my natural father, and in this sense my creator, is but the first representative of a supernatural father and creator of the universe. Many psychoanalysts have interpreted all religion merely in terms of sublimation, and thus have reduced all religious experience, be it conscious or unconscious and repressed, to infantile sexuality. To this one might say, no one will be able to make us believe that man is a sublimated animal once we can show that within him there is a repressed angel. Chapter 6. Unconscious Religiousness. By examining the results attained in the previous five chapters, together with results previously obtained by existential analysis, it can be seen that the approach has been developed in three main stages. The starting point was the basic phenomenological fact that being human is being conscious and being responsible, culminating in a synthesis of both, namely in one's consciousness of his responsibleness. The second stage of development was reached when existential analysis ventured into unconscious spirituality. In 1926, logotherapy, the clinical application of our existential analytic approach, it extended the scope of psychotherapy beyond the psyche, beyond the psychological dimension, to include the noological dimension, or the logos. In the second stage, the unconscious logos was disclosed with the discovery of a spiritual unconscious in addition to the instinctual unconscious. In these unconscious spiritual depths, the great existential choices are made. It follows, then, that man's being responsible reaches down into an unconscious ground. Thus, besides conscious responsibleness, there must also be unconscious responsibleness. With the discovery of the spiritual unconscious, existential analysis eluded the peril to which psychoanalysis has succumbed, namely, of idifying the unconscious. With the concept of the spiritual unconscious, existential analytical logotherapy also avoided one-sided intellectualism and rationalism in its theory of man. Logos is deeper than logic. Thus, the fact that man can no longer be considered as a totally rational being has been recognized by logotherapy without falling prey to the other extreme, i.e., idolizing the irrational and the instinctual, as did psychoanalysis. Now, in its third stage of development, existential analysis has uncovered, within the spiritual unconscious, unconscious religiousness. This unconscious religiousness, revealed by our phenomenological analysis, is to be understood as a latent relation to transcendence inherent in man. If one prefers, one might conceive of this relation in terms of a relationship between the immanent self and a transcendent thou. However one wishes to formulate it, we are confronted with what I should like to term the transcendent unconscious, as part and parcel of the spiritual unconscious. This concept means no more or less than that man has always stood in an intentional relation to transcendence, even if only on an unconscious level. If one calls the intentional referent of such an unconscious relation God, it is apt to speak of an unconscious God. This, however, in no way implies that God is unconscious to himself, but rather that God may be unconscious to man and that man's relation to God may be unconscious. In the Psalms, mention is made of the hidden God, and Hellenistic culture dedicated an altar to the unknown God. Similarly, our concept of an unconscious God refers to man's hidden relation to a God who himself is hidden. The phrase unconscious God could be misinterpreted in three ways. First of all, it could be misinterpreted as pantheistic. It would be a complete misconception to assume that the unconscious is itself divine. It is only related to the divine. That man has an unconscious relation to God does not at all mean that God is within us, that he inhabits our unconscious. All this is but a notion of theological dilettantism. Another potential misinterpretation of the unconscious God concept would be to take it in the sense of occultism. The paradox of an unconscious knowledge of God would be mistakenly interpreted to mean that the unconscious is omniscient, or even knows better than the conscious self. Not only is the unconscious not divine, but furthermore it does not possess any attribute of the divine, and thus lacks divine omniscience as well. As the first misinterpretation had to be rejected as theological dilettantism, the second one amounts to instant metaphysics. No knowledge can come to know itself, to judge itself, without rising above itself. In the same vein, no science can weigh its own results and realize their implications without transcending its own ontic sphere and subjecting itself to ontological scrutiny. That is the reason that compelled us to go beyond the borders of strict science in order to see how the result of our phenomenological, and in this sense empirical, investigation matched up with the ontological expectations. This makes it even more important to keep the firm ground of empirical and clinical data under our feet, lest we fall into what we denoted as theological dilettantism and instant metaphysics. Our task is to start with simple experiential facts and to evaluate them along the lines of traditional psychiatric methodology, for example, by invoking the classical method of free association in our dream analyses. To be sure, while so doing, we paid tribute to phenomenological facts as well, These facts, too, are factual, and they are so to the extent that they do not allow for any further analytical reduction. Consider the flagrantly religious dreams of what were known to be manifestly irreligious patients. What is most striking in such dreams is an ecstatic experience of bliss that was unknown to the patient in his waking life. It is simply impossible to insist that behind such an experience there must be a sexual meaning, unless we choose to violate our intellectual honesty by pressing phenomena into the Procrustean bed, not to say the Procrustean couch, of preconceived patterns of interpretation. And now to the third and most important potential misinterpretation. It cannot be emphasized strongly enough that not only is the unconscious neither divine nor omniscient, but above all, man's unconscious relation to God is profoundly personal. The unconscious God must not be mistaken as an impersonal force operant in man. This misunderstanding was the great mistake to which C.G. Jung fell prey. Jung must be credited with having discovered distinctly religious elements within the unconscious. Yet he misplaced this unconscious religiousness of man, failing to locate the unconscious God in the personal and existential region. Instead, he allotted it to the region of drives and instincts, where unconscious religiousness no longer remained a matter of choice and decision. According to Jung, something within me is religious, but it is not I who then is religious. Something within me drives me to God, but it is not I who makes the choice and takes the responsibility. For Jung, unconscious religiousness was bound up with religious archetypes belonging to the collective unconscious. For him, unconscious religiousness has scarcely anything to do with a personal decision, but becomes an essentially impersonal, collective, typical, i.e. archetypical, process occurring in man. However, it is our contention that religiousness could emerge least of all from a collective unconscious, precisely because religion involves the most personal decisions man makes, even if only on an unconscious level. But there is no possibility of leaving such decisions to some processes merely taking place in me. For Jung and the Jungians, unconscious religiousness has always remained something more or less instinctual. H. Benziger, in a paper published in 1947 in the Schweizerische Zeitschrift für Psychologie, even bluntly declares, "We may speak of a religious drive just as we speak of sexual and aggressive drives." But what sort of religion would that be? A religion to which I am driven, driven just as I am driven to sex? As for myself, I would not give a damn for a religiousness that I owed to some religious drive. Genuine religiousness has not the character of drivenness, but rather that of decidingness. Indeed, religiousness stands with its decidingness and falls with its drivenness. In a word, religiousness is either existential or not at all. For Jung, however, and in this respect he does not really differ from Freud, the unconscious, including its religious aspects, is something that determines the person. In contrast, we contend that the religious unconscious, or for that matter the spiritual unconscious, is a deciding being unconscious rather than a being driven by the unconscious. As we see it, the spiritual unconscious and even more its religious aspects, that is to say, what we have called the transcendent unconscious, is an existential agent rather than an instinctual factor. As such, it belongs to spiritual existence rather than psychophysical facticity. This, however, was completely neglected by Jung when he wrote that archetypes should be understood as a structural property or condition characteristic of the psyche, which is in some way connected with the brain. Thereby, religiousness becomes entirely a matter of the somatic and psychic conditions of human existence, while it is really a matter of the spiritual person who builds on those conditions. As Jung saw it, the religious archetypes are impersonal forms of the collective unconscious that can be unearthed as more or less preformed psychological facts, and as such pertain to psychophysical facticity. From this region they operate as autonomous powers, autonomous in the sense that they are independent of personal decisions. Our point of view, however, is that unconscious religiousness stems from the personal center of the individual man rather than an impersonal pool of images shared by mankind. If we respect the spiritual and existential character of unconscious religiousness, rather than allotting it to the realm of psychological facticity, it also becomes impossible to regard it as something innate. Since it is not tied up with heredity in the biological sense, it cannot be inherited either. This is not to deny that all religiousness always proceeds within certain pre-established paths and patterns of development. These, however, are not innate, inherited archetypes, but given cultural molds into which personal religiousness is poured. These molds are not transmitted in a biological way, but are passed down through the world of traditional symbols indigenous to a given culture. This world of symbols is not inborn in us, but we are born into it. Thus, there are religious forms, and they wait to be assimilated by man in an existential way, i.e., to be made his own. But what serves this purpose is not any archetype, but rather the prayers of our fathers, the rites of our churches and synagogues, the revelations of our prophets, and the examples set by saints and tzaddiks. Culture offers enough traditional molds for man to fill with lived religion. No one has to invent God. On the other hand, no one carries him along in the form of an innate archetype. Primary religiousness, therefore, must not simply be identified with primitive or archaic religiousness. However, it is true time and again that primary religiousness that has fallen prey to repression comes to the surface in the form of a naive or childlike faith. But nothing else should be expected, for such religiousness necessarily is associated with experiential material accrued during childhood. In fact, whenever an existential analysis unearths this material and releases it from repression, we are confronted with a faith that indeed is childlike in the truest, best sense of the word. No matter how childlike and naive it may be, it is in no way primitive, nor is it archaic in the sense of Jung's archetypes. If one embarks on an unbiased analysis, he will not be confronted with elements of a pseudo-archaic mythology, but rather with religious experiences engraved in memories from one's childhood. Existential analysis has moved even further beyond Freud's view of religion. It is no longer necessary to ponder the future of an illusion, but our thoughts do revolve around the apparent timelessness of a reality, around the ever-present reality that man's intrinsic religiousness has revealed itself to be. It is a reality in the strict sense of phenomenological empiricism. To be sure, it also is a reality that can remain or again become unconscious or be repressed. Precisely in such cases, however, it is the task of logotherapy to remind the patient of his unconscious religiousness, that is to say, to let it enter his conscious mind again. After all, it is the business of existential analytic logotherapy to trace the neurotic mode of being to its ultimate ground. Sometimes the ground of neurotic existence is to be seen in a deficiency, in that a person's relation to transcendence is repressed. But although concealed in the transcendent unconscious, repressed transcendence shows up and makes itself noticeable as an unrest of the heart. In my book, The Doctor and the Soul, I described a case in which this restlessness precipitated a psychosomatic, or really noosomatic, heart condition. So what holds for the unconscious in general is also true of unconscious religiousness in particular. Religiousness winds up in neurosis. There is clinical evidence for this assertion. Take the example of a patient suffering from a severe obsessive-compulsive neurosis that for decades had defied long-term treatment by various psychoanalysts. The symptomological picture was dominated by the obsessive fear that whatever he did might eventuate in the eternal damnation of his late mother or sister. For this reason, the patient would not accept a government position, for he would have had to take an oath of office, which at some later time he might have violated, if only in a trifling way. In consequence, mother and sister would be damned. The patient had also evaded marriage, simply because he would have had to say, "I do," at the wedding. And if he were ever somehow to go against his marriage vows, that could also have led to the damnation of his dead mother and sister. He had not bought a radio just because, in the moment he was going to buy it, the obsessive thought went through his head that if he did not immediately grasp a certain technical detail, his mother and sister would have to face a terrible fate in hell. Confronted with such an abundance of more or less religious references in the patient's account, we asked him what his attitude was toward religion. To our surprise, it turned out that he considered himself a full-fledged freethinker. More specifically, he declared himself to be a follower of Haeckel, a popularizer of a biologically oriented materialism well known around the turn of the century. And with obvious pride, he related how much his understanding of modern physics had advanced through private studies. For example, he had completely mastered the theory of the electron. To the question whether he knew anything about religious matters, he indeed admitted that he knew the prayer book, but only as the criminal knows the code of law. By this he meant that he was aware of it, but did not care for it. To the question whether, then, he was irreligious, he responded, "Who can say that of himself? Sure, I am irreligious intellectually, but emotionally I still might believe. Intellectually I believe only in natural laws, not in anything such as a God who rewards and punishes." And behold, the same individual who uttered these words had shortly before, when reporting on his sexual impotence, remarked, "At that moment I was haunted by the obsessive idea that God could take revenge on me." Freud, in The Future of an Illusion, said, "Religion is the universal compulsive neurosis of mankind. Like that of the child, it derives from the Oedipal complex, from the relationship to the father." In view of the case history abstracted above, we are tempted to reverse Freud's statement and dare to say compulsive neurosis may well be diseased religiousness. In fact, clinical evidence suggests that atrophy of the religious sense in man results in a distortion of his religious concepts. Or to put it in a less clinical vein, once the angel in us is repressed, he turns into a demon. There is even a parallel on the sociocultural level, for time and again we watch and witness how repressed religion degenerates into superstition. In our century, a deified reason and a megalomaniac technology are the repressive structures to which the religious feeling is sacrificed. This fact explains much of the present condition of man, which indeed resembles a universal compulsive neurosis of mankind, to quote Freud. Much of man's present condition? Yes, with one exception, religion. With special reference to technology, however, one is reminded of a dictum by Goethe. "He who possesses art and science also has religion." But today, we know only too well where man would wind up if he had science and nothing beyond it. Soon the only thing that would be left of all his science would be the atom bombs he possessed. But let us turn away from problems of humanity and return to the compulsive neurosis of the individual. In concluding this chapter, we might venture to say that God is a vengeful God indeed, for neurotic existence in some cases seems to be the toll that a crippled relation to transcendence takes on man. Chapter 7. Psychotherapy and Theology. We may well ask what bearing all the questions raised so far might have on research and practice in the field of psychiatry. After all, it is not for the medical profession to be interested in theological problems. When such matters come into discussion, the physician is bound to unconditional tolerance. Least of all is a physician who personally is religious released from this obligation. He will only be interested in a spontaneous breakthrough of religiousness on the part of the patient, and he will be patient enough to wait for such a spontaneous development to take place. This should not be difficult for him, since precisely he, as a religious person, is convinced that even in a manifestly irreligious person there must be latent religiousness. After all, the religious psychiatrist believes not only in God, but also in an unconscious belief on the part of the patient. In other words, he believes that his own God is the unconscious God of the patient. And at the same time, he believes that this unconscious God is one who has simply not yet become conscious to the patient. We have said that religion is genuine only where it is existential, where a man is not somehow driven to it, but commits himself to it by freely choosing to be religious. Now we have seen that the existentiality of religiousness has to be matched by its spontaneity. Genuine religiousness must unfold in its own time. Never can anyone be forced to it. So we may say, to genuine religiousness, man cannot be driven by an instinct, nor pushed by a psychiatrist. As Freud has taught us, the process by which unconscious material becomes conscious has a therapeutic effect only if the process takes place spontaneously. The working through of repressed material is based on its spontaneously breaking through, and I think that something analogous also holds for repressed religiousness. Here, to exert any pressure along the lines of a pre-established program would be self-defeating. In this case, intention would thwart the effect. This is a fact of which even the clergy is quite aware. Even the clergy would insist on the full spontaneity of true religiousness. All the more should a psychiatrist. I well remember, for example, how a priest described being called to the deathbed of a man whom he knew to be irreligious. The man had simply felt the need to speak out his mind before he died and had for this purpose chosen the priest. The priest told me that he had refrained from offering the last rites to the man for the simple reason that he had not spontaneously asked for them. So great was the priest's own insistence on spontaneity. But should we psychiatrists be more priestly than the priests? Should we not instead have at least as much respect as this priest had for the free decisions of our patients, particularly in religious matters? But time and again psychotherapists try to outdo even the priests. This is just hubris. The function of the psychiatrist cannot be distinguished sharply enough from the mission of the clergy. Just as the irreligious psychiatrist should let the religious patient have his belief, likewise, the religious psychiatrist must let the priest keep his priestly office. Elsewhere, we have shown that it is characteristic of obsessive-compulsive patients to be dominated by a Faustian will that everything be 100%, that absolute certainty be reached in their acts of cognition and decision. As it were, they are hung up on the promise of the serpent, Eritis sicut Deus, scientum bonum et malum. You will be like God, knowing what is good and what is evil. And of those psychotherapists who try to usurp the duties of the clergy, we may say that they wish esse sicut pastores, demonstrantes bonum et malum. They wish to be not like God, but like the priests, not knowing but showing what is good and what is evil. We have often said that logotherapy is not meant to substitute for psychotherapy, but rather to supplement it. Likewise, we have often pointed out that what we call medical ministry is in no way supposed to replace the pastoral ministry. This, however, does not do away with the possibility that the psychiatrist, if need be, may take over the function of the priest. The following is an instance of how this can happen. An old woman came to the psychotherapeutic outpatient clinic of our department to consult us on her severe depression. She had no family left since her daughter, her only child, had recently committed suicide. She could not get over that. After her mourning showed itself to be not pathological but a normal reaction, the psychiatrist cautiously asked her how she felt about religion. Since the patient said she was religious, he inquired why then she had not instead sought the help of a priest. She replied that she had gone to her priest, but he had not had even a few minutes for her. However, the psychiatrist, himself a religious man, could easily give this woman the consolation she needed, that consolation on the grounds of their common faith that her priest had not been able to provide. The situation required that the psychiatrist take the place of the priest in order to give religious comfort. This was not only his human right, but even his religious duty, for in this case one religious person was confronting another. What we wish to stress, however, is that the psychiatrist is never entitled to such a religious approach qua psychiatrist, but only as a religious person. Furthermore, only a psychiatrist who is himself a religious person is justified in bringing religion into psychotherapy. An irreligious psychiatrist never has the right to manipulate the patient's religious feelings by employing religion as just another useful tool to try, along with such things as pills, shots, and shocks. This would be to debase religion and degrade it to a mere device for improving mental health. Although religion might have a very positive psychotherapeutic effect on the patient, its intention is in no way a psychotherapeutic one. Although religion might secondarily promote such things as mental health and inner equilibrium, its aim does not primarily concern psychological solutions, but rather spiritual salvation. Religion is not an insurance policy for a tranquil life, for maximum freedom from conflicts, or for any other hygienic goal. Religion provides man with more than psychotherapy ever could, but it also demands more of him. Any fusion of the respective goals of religion and psychotherapy must result in confusion. The fact remains that the intentions of the two are different, even if their effects might overlap. In the same vein, any attempt to merge the medical ministry with the pastoral one is to be rejected. There are some authors who propose that psychotherapy relinquish its autonomy as a science and its independence from religion in favor of seeing its function as that of an ancilla theologiae. As is well known, for centuries philosophy was allotted the role of such an ancilla theologiae, i.e., a handmaid in the service of theology. However, just as the dignity of man is based on his freedom, to the extent that he may even say no to God, so the dignity of a science is based on that unconditional freedom that guarantees its independent search for truth. And just as human freedom must include the freedom to say no, so the freedom of scientific investigation must face the risk that its results will turn out to contradict religious beliefs and convictions. Only a scientist who is ready to fight militantly for such autonomy of thought may triumphantly live to see how the results of his research eventually fit, without contradictions, in the truths of his belief. Speaking of dignity, be it the dignity of man or that of science, we may define it as the value of something in itself, as opposed to its value for me. Thus, we could say that whoever tries to make psychotherapy into an ancilla theologiae, a servant to theology, not only robs it of the dignity of an autonomous science, but also takes away the potential value it might have for religion. Because psychotherapy can be useful to religion only in terms of a byproduct or a side effect, and never if its usefulness is intended from the start. If psychotherapy is ever to serve religion, either by the results of its empirical investigation or by the therapeutic effects of treatment, psychotherapy has to refrain from setting any preconceived goals along religious lines. Only those results that have been obtained by independent research, uninfluenced by presuppositions borrowed from religion, can ever be of use and value for theology. And if psychotherapy is ever to offer evidence that the human psyche really is what we think it is, namely, anima naturaliter religiosa, religious by nature, such evidence can only be offered by a psychotherapy that is scientia naturaliter irreligiosa, that is to say, a psychotherapy that by its very nature is not and can never be religiously oriented. The less psychotherapy condescends to serve theology as a handmaid, the greater will be the service it actually performs. One need not be a servant to be able to serve. Chapter 8. New Research in Logotherapy, circa 1975. In the preface to the first English edition of The Unconscious God, 1975, I promised to examine some of the tenets that, since the first publication in German in 1947, have been further elaborated. Understandably, I will have to concentrate on conscience as one of the most important phenomena central to these tenets. According to the logotherapeutic theory, conscience has a very specific function. However, in order to fully clarify this function, I must first chart the motivation theory as it underlies logotherapy. According to most of the current motivation theories, man is a being basically concerned with gratifying needs and satisfying drives and instincts. He does so in the final analysis only to alleviate the inner tension created by them, to the end of maintaining or restoring an inner equilibrium called homeostasis. This is a concept originally borrowed from biology, but that was eventually found even there to be untenable. Ludwig von Bertalanffy, had long maintained and demonstrated that primordial biological phenomena such as growth and reproduction cannot be explained along the lines of the homeostasis principle. Kurt Goldstein even proved that only a brain that is functioning pathologically is characterized by the attempt to avoid tension unconditionally. I, for one, think that man is never primarily concerned with any inner condition, such as the inner equilibrium, but rather with something or someone out there in the world, be it a cause to serve or a partner to love. And if he really loves the partner, he certainly does not just use him as a more or less apt means to satisfy his own needs. Thus, human existence, at least as long as it has not been neurotically distorted, is always directed to something or someone other than itself, be it a meaning to fulfill or another human being to encounter lovingly. I have termed this constitutive characteristic of human existence self-transcendence. What is called self-actualization is ultimately an effect, the unintentional byproduct of self-transcendence. So it turns out that Pindar's imperative that one should become what one is, in other words, that man should actualize his potentialities, is valid only if we add what Carl Jaspers once said. What one is, he has become through that cause which he has made his own. Or, as Abraham H. Maslow put it, the business of self-actualization can best be carried out via a commitment to an important job. Just as self-actualization can be obtained only through a detour, through the fulfillment of meaning, so identity is available only through responsibility, through being responsible for the fulfillment of meaning. It is fitting that research conducted at Boston University, based on a new test that measures the collective neurosis as formulated by logotherapy, shows that there appears to be a negative correlation between the collective neurosis and responsibility. Therefore, man is originally characterized by his search for meaning rather than his search for himself. The more he forgets himself, giving himself to a cause or another person, the more human he is. And the more he is immersed and absorbed in something or someone other than himself, the more he really becomes himself. Just consider a child who, absorbed in play, forgets himself. This is the moment to take a snapshot. When you wait until he notices that you are taking a picture, his face congeals and freezes, showing his unnatural self-consciousness rather than his natural graciousness. Why do most people have that stereotyped expression on their faces whenever they are photographed? This expression stems from their concern with the impression that they are going to leave on the onlooker. It is cheese that makes them so ugly. Forgetting themselves, the photographer and the future onlooker would make them beautiful. Consider the eye. The eye, too, is self-transcendent in a way. The moment it perceives something of itself, its function, to perceive the surrounding world visually, has deteriorated. If it is afflicted with a cataract, it may perceive its own cataract as a cloud, and if it is suffering from glaucoma, it might see its own glaucoma as a rainbow halo around lights. Normally, however, the eye doesn't see anything of itself. Equally, by virtue of the self-transcendent quality of the human reality, the humanness of man is most tangible when he forgets himself and overlooks himself. One of the two aspects of self-transcendence, namely reaching out for a meaning to fulfill, is identical with what I have come to call the will to meaning. This concept, which occupies such a central place in the motivation theory of logotherapy, denotes the fundamental fact that normally, or in neurotic cases originally, man is striving to find and fulfill meaning and purpose in life. This concept of a will to meaning has been empirically corroborated and validated by several authors who base their research on tests and statistics. James C. Crumbaugh and Leonard T. Mihalik's Purpose in Life Test, or PIL, and Elizabeth S. Lucas's Logo Test were given to thousands of subjects. And after the data had been computerized, it was evident that the will to meaning is more than just the wishful thinking of some idealists. Research conducted by S. Kratochvil and I. Planova of the Department of Psychology of the University of Brno, Czechoslovakia, offered evidence that the will to meaning is really a specific need not reducible to other needs, and is in greater or smaller degree present in all human beings. The relevance of the frustration of this need, the authors continue, was documented also by case material concerning neurotic and depressive patients. In some cases, the frustration of the will to meaning had a relevant role as an etiological factor in the origin of the neurosis or of the suicidal attempt. Abraham H. Maslow goes further. To him, the will to meaning is more than an irreducible need. He sees it as man's primary concern. If there were still a need to demonstrate that the concept of a will to meaning has a realistic basis and is perfectly down to earth, one might consider the result of a survey published by the American Council on Education. Among the 171,509 students screened, the highest goal, held by 68.1%, was developing a meaningful philosophy of life. Another statistical survey, conducted at Johns Hopkins University and sponsored by the National Institute of Mental Health, found that among 7,948 students at 48 colleges, only 16% said their first goal was making a lot of money. 78% of the students, however, checked finding a purpose and meaning to my life. 78%, which, as it happens, is exactly the percentage of Polish youngsters who regarded it as their highest purpose in life to improve their living standard. Apparently, Maslow's hierarchy of needs is applicable to the issue at hand. First, one has to improve one's living standard, and only after this has been accomplished may he approach the task of finding a purpose and meaning in his life. However, I regard this as a mistake. It goes without saying that someone who is ill wishes, in the first place, to become healthy, so health will seem to constitute his supreme goal in life. But in actual fact, it is no more than a means to an end, because health is a precondition for attaining whatever might be considered the real meaning in a given instance. In other words, in such a case, it is first mandatory to inquire what is the end that stands behind the means, and an appropriate method for such an inquiry may well be some sort of a Socratic dialogue. As we see, Maslow's motivation theory does not suffice here, for what is needed is not so much the distinction between higher and lower needs, but rather an answer to the question of whether the individual goals are mere means or meanings. In everyday life, we are fully aware of this difference. If we did not recognize it, we wouldn't laugh at a comic strip that shows Snoopy complaining of his suffering from a feeling of meaninglessness and emptiness, until Charlie Brown comes in with a bowl full of dog food and Snoopy exclaims, "Ah, meaning!" What makes us laugh is precisely the confusion of means and meaning. While food is certainly a necessary condition for survival, it is not a sufficient condition to endow one's life with meaning and thus relieve the sense of meaninglessness and emptiness. The findings of the study done at Johns Hopkins University are paralleled by those from a study carried out at the University of Michigan. 1,533 working people were asked to rank various aspects of work in order of importance, and good pay came in a distant fifth. Small wonder that Joseph Katz of the State University of New York, reviewing some recent opinion polls, said that the next wave of personnel entering industry will be interested in careers with meaning, not money. As we see, the will to meaning cannot be explained away as merely philosophical apparel for traditional dynamic concepts, to quote from a study by James C. Crumbaugh. In fact, current psychodynamic theory and the therapy based on it are too narrow in scope to explain the behavior of the younger generation and reach them, as Z.J. Lipowski says. What is even more important is the danger that man, and here again particularly the younger generation, may be corrupted by being underrated. Conversely, if I am cognizant of the higher aspirations of man, such as his will to meaning, I am also able to muster and mobilize them. I am always reminded in this context of the business my flight instructor calls crabbing. If there is a crosswind, say from the north, and the airport where I wish to land lies east, and I fly east, I will miss my destination because my plane will drift to the southeast. So to compensate for this drift, I have to fly my plane in a direction north of my destination, and this is called crabbing. But isn't it the same with man? Doesn't he, too, wind up at some point that is lower than his destination unless he is seen on a level that includes his higher aspirations? What did my flight instructor say? If I fly east in a so-called crosswind condition, I will land south of east. If I head north of east, I will land east. Well, if I take man as he is, I make him worse. If I take him as he ought to be, I make him become what he can be. But this is no longer something my flight instructor told me, but rather a literal quotation from Goethe. If the concept of a will to meaning is idealistic at all, I would call such idealism the real realism. If we are to bring out the human potential at its best, we must first believe in its existence and presence. Otherwise, man too will drift. He will deteriorate. For there is a human potential at its worst as well. And in spite of our belief in the potential humanness of man, we must not close our eyes to the fact that humane humans are, and probably will always remain, a minority. But it is precisely for this reason that each of us is challenged to join the minority. Things are bad, but unless we do our best to improve them, everything will become worse. On the one hand, the will to meaning is not only a true manifestation of man's humanness, but also, as has been substantiated by Theodore A. Kotchin, a reliable criterion of mental health. This hypothesis is supported by James C. Crumbaugh, Sister Mary Raphael, and Raymond R. Schrader, who measured the will to meaning and obtained the highest scores among well-motivated and successful professional and business populations. On the other hand, lack of meaning and purpose is indicative of emotional maladjustment. Since Freud and Adler had to deal with neurotic patients, that is to say with people frustrated in their will to meaning, it is understandable that they thought that man is motivated by the pleasure principle and the striving for superiority, respectively. Actually, the will to power and what one might call a will to pleasure are substitutes for a frustrated will to meaning. Evidence of the surrogate nature of the will to pleasure has been offered by statistical research. People visiting Vienna's Prater, an amusement park somewhat comparable to New York's Coney Island, proved to be more frustrated in their will to meaning than the average population of Vienna. Primarily and normally, man does not seek pleasure. Instead, pleasure, or for that matter, happiness, is the side effect of living out the self-transcendence of existence. Once one has served a cause or is involved in loving another human being, happiness occurs by itself. The will to pleasure, however, contradicts the self-transcendent quality of human reality, and it also defeats itself. For pleasure and happiness are byproducts. Happiness must ensue. It cannot be pursued. It is the very pursuit of happiness that thwarts happiness. The more one makes happiness an aim, the more he misses the aim. And this is most conspicuous in cases of sexual neurosis, such as frigidity or impotence. Sexual performance or experience is strangled to the extent to which it is made either an object of attention or an object of intention. I have called the first hyperreflection and the second hyperintention. Hyperintention is observable even on a mass level. Just consider the emphasis that public opinion places on sexual achievement. As I have pointed out elsewhere, this emphasis spawns preoccupations and apprehensions. People are overly concerned with sexual success and ridden with the fear of sexual failure. But fear tends to bring about precisely that of which one is afraid. Thus, a vicious circle is established, and it accounts for much of the caseload regarding sexual neuroses that confronts psychiatrists today. What is behind the emphasis on sexual achievement and power? What is behind this will to sexual pleasure and happiness? Is again the frustrated will to meaning. Sexual libido only hypertrophies in an existential vacuum. The result is an inflation of sex, and like inflation on the money market, it is associated with a devaluation. More specifically, sex is devalued because it is dehumanized. Human sex is always more than mere sex, and it is more than mere sex precisely to the extent that it serves as the physical expression of something metasexual, the physical expression of love. And only to the extent that sex carries out this function of embodying, incarnating, love, only to this extent will it climax in a truly rewarding experience. Seen in this light, Maslow was justified when he pointed out that those people who cannot love never get the same thrill out of sex as those who can love. Therefore, we would have to recommend that sex be rehumanized, if only for the purpose of maximizing one's orgasm. This was recently substantiated by a report on 20,000 responses to 101 questions about sexual attitudes and practices. It revealed that among the factors contributing to high orgasm and potency rates, the most important one was romanticism. And yet, it is not quite accurate to say that human sex is more than mere sex. As the ethologist Irenaeus Ibelibesfeld has shown, in some vertebrates, sexual behavior serves group cohesion, and this is particularly the case in man's biological ancestors, those primates that live in groups. Thus, in certain apes, sexual intercourse sometimes serves a social purpose exclusively. In humans, Ibelibesfeld states, there is no doubt that sexual intercourse serves not only the propagation of the species, but also the monogamous relation between the partners. It goes without saying that the sexual instinct cannot in itself be distinctly human. After all, it is not only a property of human beings, but is shared by animals as well. So let us more cautiously say that in man the sexual instinct is humanized to a higher or a lower degree, as the case may be. In him, the sexual instinct approaches and approximates the potential of human sex only successively. And as we have seen, the potential of human sex consists in its becoming an embodiment of love. This sexual maturation is characterized by three developmental stages. The first two can be understood along the lines of Freud's differentiation between the goal of an instinct and the instinct's object. At the immature level, only a goal is sought, and the goal is tension reduction irrespective of the way in which it is accomplished. Masturbation may do. According to Freud, the mature stage is reached as soon as the sexual instinct centers on normal sexual intercourse, which presupposes an object. As I see it, however, the object is not enough to guarantee a mature sexual life. For as long as an individual uses a partner simply for the purpose of reducing tension, he really masturbates on the partner, as our patients so often say. To the individual who really is mature, the partner is in no way a means to an end. The mature individual's partnership moves on a human level, and the human level precludes the mere use of others. On the human level, I do not use another human being, but I encounter him, which means that I fully recognize his humanness. And if I take another step by fully recognizing, beyond his humanness as a human being, his uniqueness as a person, it is even more than an encounter. What then takes place is love. Grasping the uniqueness of a partner understandably results in a monogamous partnership. There are no longer interchangeable partners. Conversely, if one is not able to love, he winds up with promiscuity. As masturbation means being content with tension reduction as a goal, so promiscuity means being contented with the partner as an object. In neither case is the human potential of sex actualized. As long as one remains at the mere goal level, one's sexual instinct may be catered to by pornography. And as long as he stays at the mere object level, his sexual instinct may be catered to by prostitutes. Thus, promiscuity and pornography are the marks of fixation at, or regression to, immature levels of development. Therefore, it is not wise publicly to glorify the indulgence in such patterns of regressive behavior by confusing it with a progressive mentality. As to pornography, I detest the invocation of freedom from censorship, when what is really meant is simply the freedom to make money. As compared with the hypocrisy of businessmen working in the field of so-called sex education, I praise the honesty of the call girls who bluntly confess that they are only out to make money through sex. And as to promiscuity, it is not only a type of regressive behavior, but also contradicts the humanness of man. But sexual promiscuity is promulgated together with sexual intimacy, and the latter is even believed to be the answer to the ills of our age. However, I think that what is needed in this age of population explosion is existential privacy rather than sexual intimacy. Speaking of population explosion, I would like to touch on the pill. It is not only counteracting the population explosion, but, as I see it, rendering an even greater service. If it is true that it is love that makes sex human, the pill allows for a truly human sexual life, one in which, freed from its automatic connection with procreation, sex can realize its highest potential as one of the most direct and meaningful expressions of love. Sex is human if it is experienced as a vehicle of love, and to make it into a mere means to an end contradicts the humanness of sex, regardless of whether the pleasure principle dictates the end or the procreation instinct does so. As to the latter, sex has been emancipated, thanks to the pill, and has thereby become capable of achieving its potential status as a human phenomenon. Today, the will to meaning is often frustrated. In logotherapy, one speaks of existential frustration. We psychiatrists are confronted more than ever before with patients who are complaining of a feeling of futility that at present plays at least as important a role as did the feeling of inferiority in Alfred Adler's time. Let me just quote from a letter I recently received from a young American student. I am a 22-year-old with degree, car, security, and the availability of more sex and power than I need. Now I have only to explain to myself what it all means. However, such people are complaining not only of a sense of meaninglessness, but also of emptiness. And that is why I have described this condition in terms of the existential vacuum. There is no doubt that the existential vacuum is increasing and spreading. According to a report I was shown recently, the percentage of those suffering from it, among a population of 500 Viennese youngsters, has increased within the last 2 years from 30% to 80%. Even in Africa, the existential vacuum is spreading, particularly among the academic youth. Also, Freudians are fully aware of this phenomenon, and so are Marxists. At an international meeting of psychoanalysts, it was stated that ever more patients are suffering from a lack of life content, rather than clinical symptomatology, and that this state of affairs may well account for so-called interminable analyses, because, as the Freudians have contended, in such cases, the psychoanalytic treatment becomes the only life content available to the patient. As to the Marxists, only recently the head of the Department of Psychotherapy at Karl Marx University in Leipzig confessed to the frequency of the existential vacuum as substantiated by her own investigations. As the head of the psychiatry department at a Czech university puts it, the existential vacuum is passing the borders between capitalist and communist countries without a visa. If asked for a brief explanation, I would say that the existential vacuum derives from the following conditions. Unlike an animal, man is not told by drives and instincts what he must do. And in contrast to man in former times, he is no longer told by traditions and values what he should do. Now, knowing neither what he must do nor what he should do, he sometimes does not even know what he basically wishes to do. Instead, he wishes to do what other people do, which is conformism, or he does what other people wish him to do, which is totalitarianism. In addition to these two effects of the existential vacuum, there is a third, namely neuroticism. The existential vacuum per se is not a neurosis, at least not in the strictly clinical sense. If it is a neurosis at all, it would have to be diagnosed as a sociogenic neurosis. However, there are also cases in which the existential vacuum results in clinical symptomatology. Such patients are suffering from what I have called noagenic neurosis. James C. Crumbaugh must be credited with having developed a special diagnostic test to differentiate the noagenic from other forms of neurosis. Scores of research projects have been based on his PIL test. The results thereby obtained indicate that about 20% of the neuroses one encounters are noagenic in nature and origin. Elizabeth S. Lucas, although using a different test, her LOGO test, has arrived at the same percentage as Crumbaugh. As to the existential vacuum, however, which in itself is not a neurosis, a statistical survey recently showed that among my European students, 25% had themselves had this abyss experience, as it may be called, in contradistinction to the peak experience. Among my American students, it was not 25, but 60%. A communist psychiatrist found that among various populations of Czech students, the percentage of those who had experienced the existential vacuum as measured by Krumbaugh's test was even higher than that observed and reported among students in the United States. A year later, however, the figure had become markedly lower. During that intervening year, most of the students had become involved in Dubček's movement, his battle for political liberalization and for the humanization of communism. They had been given a cause for which to fight, for which to live, and, unfortunately, for which to die. On the average, however, the fact remains that in America the existential vacuum is more manifest than in Europe. As I see it, this is due to the exposure of the average American student to an indoctrination along the lines of reductionism. To cite an instance, there is a book in which man is defined as nothing but a complex biochemical mechanism powered by a combustion system which energizes computers with prodigious storage facilities for retaining encoded information. Or to quote another example, man is defined as a naked ape. By offering our students such reductionist concepts of man, we are reinforcing their existential vacuum. I well remember how I felt when I was a 13-year-old junior high school student, and our natural science teacher told us that life in the final analysis was nothing but a combustion process, an oxidation process. I sprang to my feet and said, "Professor, if this is the case, what meaning then does life have?" To be sure, in his case, reductionism had taken on the form of oxidationism, one might say. A study of physicians by R.N. Gray and associates showed that during medical school, cynicism as a rule increases, while humanitarianism decreases. Only after completion of medical studies is this trend reversed, but unfortunately not in all subjects. Small wonder, I would say. Just consider the two definitions offered by the author in whose paper this study was quoted. Man is defined as nothing but an adaptive control system, and values are defined as nothing but homeostatic restraints in a stimulus-response process. According to another reductionist definition, values are nothing but reaction formations and defense mechanisms. As for myself, I am not prepared to live for the sake of my reaction formations, even less to die for the sake of my defense mechanisms. Here is another illustration regarding reductionism. A famous Freudian psychoanalyst devoted two volumes to Goethe. In the 1,538 pages, a review of the book reads, the author portrays to us a genius with the earmarks of a manic depressive, paranoid, and epileptoid disorder, of homosexuality, incest, voyeurism, exhibitionism, fetishism, impotence, narcissism, obsessive compulsive neurosis, hysteria, megalomania, etc. He seems to focus almost exclusively upon the instinctual dynamic forces that underlie the artistic product. We are led to believe that Goethe's work is but the result of pre-genital fixations. His struggle does not really aim for an ideal, for beauty, for values, but for the overcoming of an embarrassing problem of premature ejaculation. How wise and cautious was Freud as compared with his epigones, when he remarked that sometimes a cigar may be a cigar and nothing but a cigar. To be sure, a Freudian would have to interpret Freud's statement as a rationalization of his cigar smoking.